Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare Short-Term Insurance Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spannersready, and I'm joined by Matt Two Rumpets. How's it going there, Matt?
Happy Consume Chocolate Day.
Oh, I do love me an Easter egg. We left my son's big Easter egg on the windowsill of the living room. And when he went to open it, it was completely melted and was just in the bottom of the box as a lump of chocolate.
Well, it'll still taste good anyway.
Happy Easter to everybody out there. It's a very different weekend to last weekend. Last weekend, we were fully pumped and hyped up after the race. My adrenaline wasn't even close to coming down. All a bit calmer this week. But I tell you what, Matt, the level of vitriol, the level of hyperbole, the level of passion on social media after the race was incredible. And I think I'm going to apologize for how glib I was from a kind of Hamilton supporting point of view. So from my point of view, I was cheering the race on. I wouldn't have minded who'd have won. Honestly, it was such a good race. But I was a little bit, oh yeah, I was cheering and my Dutch neighbor heard me, etc. What I didn't really realize was the amount of hurt on social media from how emotionally invested Verstappen fans were, people who were fed up of Hamilton domination were, because they were promised a dethroning on Saturday night and they didn't get it on Sunday. And I think when we're this passionate and emotional about the sport, maybe I could dial it down a notch. I always try and deny the you're a Hamfosi lunatic claims. But maybe I just went one notch over, for which I will apologize.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about this situation, and I totally understand where you're coming from, is that everybody had good arguments for the points they wanted to make, but the points they were making didn't really overlap a lot in a Venn diagram point kind of way. So yeah. The Hamilton people were like, it was a stunning drive from Hamilton that if anyone else had been in that car, including Max, I think, I don't think they would have won, if I'm being honest. But that takes nothing away from the fact that Red Bull had the faster car. Max had an incredible drive, but there were some issues they had that really kept them, I think, from expressing the full potential of that car. And we will talk about them on the show a little bit later, I believe.
True. And equally, I believe that there's not many drivers that would have taken the fight to Mercedes and made it that close, apart from Max Verstappen. You know, there's maybe... maybe if we put half the rest of the grid in there, it would have been a much easier Hamilton victory. So I hope I didn't come across as being a Max hater. I'm not. I think he's funny. I think he's a fantastic talent. And if we get Verstappen versus Hamilton this year, I'll be absolutely delighted. And we're going to bring some panel on to talk to you. But first, as always, I have to remind you that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Our first panelist is PR guru and sensation, Chris Stevens. How's it going, Chris?
Hey, Spanners. I know you've been feeling a little unwell this week, and it seems to have spread through Zoom and caught on to me as well.
Did I give you Zoom flu? Yay.
Give me Zoom flu.
But apart from that, it's good to have you on. Obviously, we're not going to have you on for the majority of race reviews because you're busy representing drivers at the weekend. But from your point of view, I mean, that was a crazy weekend. I know that you've always claimed to be a neutral up at the top and to not support any driver, except for Latifi. You are, of course, you are our only Latifi fan on the panel.
Yeah, I just love Nicky. I think he's a really great guy. Having worked with him a little bit during his junior Formula days, he is the son of a billionaire, but you would not guess it from interacting with him. He's very humble. I think he's very aware of the fact that he's lucky to do what he does and to be in Formula One. And that he's just a really, really nice guy overall. And hopefully get on as many shows before we get to the real crazy end of the season. Basically, after this weekend, it's nonstop for a few months.
Yeah, I tell you what, with Latifi, you get no sense of entitlement at all. Mm. In his radio messages, he just seems to be cracking on with it and enjoying his trade.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's exactly how I'd describe him. Just a very amicable guy, which a lot of people in Formula One lack sometimes, I think.
And I'm also joined by Dutch media expert and journalist Jules Segers. Hello, Jules.
Good evening, guys.
I didn't just go out and find a token Dutch person just because of the criticism from last week.
It didn't sound like it, not at all.
You're here on merit, I promise, but I did mess up and I think I found the only Dutch Lewis Hamilton fan.
Well, Lewis Hamilton fan is maybe a bit too much, but I am an admirer of his achievements, his driving. And I think drivers that come into the sport and immediately set things on fire, I'm a fan of those, and Hamilton was one, and Jack Villeneuve was one, who I supported back in those days.
Well, and also you could definitely argue that Max Verstappen is one. He came in so young,
Absolutely. And
showed his nose very early, even in the Toro Rosso. You know, big memories of him not being afraid to chuck it down the inside of that final hairpin in China. So he's had that same sensational impact on F1.
Yeah. That's true. That's absolutely true. And over here in the Netherlands, there's no escaping that point of view.
We'll talk a little bit more about the Dutch reaction to the race in the Dutch media, because we're a bit Brit-centric here and we see the British media. But ladies and gentlemen, that is your panel, Matt Trumpets, Jules Segers and Chris Stevens. Right then, Matt, I've got a plan. You've prepared some lovely notes about what we learned from the last race. And I think what it would be good to do is extrapolate what we know from last weekend and just see how that sets us up for the season going forward a little bit. Now, last week, we spent quite a lot of time concentrating on the top two teams. I think that is understandable. So why don't we start with McLaren, who, in a way, it was a surprise third place. It was a surprise strong performance, overshadowed massively by the battle up front, but this could be a thing.
All right, so just to make it clear for the audience, when you compliment me on my notes,
right,
what you really mean is I'm going to ignore almost all of them and talk about what I want to that I decided at the last second. That's a joke, by the way.
I know.
You have used my notes because you know the topics you want to talk about, and that's why,
yes,
you do your job and I do my job. To carry on, yeah, McLaren, of all of the teams, McLaren had a lot of question marks about sustaining their third position in the championship. They got there through ruthless consistency last season. They got there by having an incredibly evenly matched pair of drivers. And so with the new engine, with the inability to develop the car in the same way as all of their rivals, it was an open question whether or not they could sustain that performance. And they answered it, yes, absolutely we can. The new Mercedes power unit worked out brilliantly for them. Their drivers were so much more closely matched in qualifying than any other pair on the grid. It was insane. I'm talking about a 0.05% difference in qualifying. And had Gasly not given Ricciardo a diffuser upgrade in the opening laps, they would have scored even more points. But as is, you look at where Norris finished, you look at the margin of victory for his P4. There was nobody in his bubble, and really only Ferrari in qualifying looked like they might be able to push him.
Their pace was so convincing, wasn't it? And I think that's what struck people the most. You know, there was some debate, oh, maybe we slipped down a position in the championship. No, they were solidly the third fastest car. When Norris was done having his amazing side-by-side action with Ricciardo in the opening lap, which lasted for much longer than I certainly would have expected to see between teammates at the first Grand Prix of the season. But once he was through, he just bolted. And sure, Ricciardo got that damage, but even then was convincingly fast.
I think it was on the Sky interviews where they were saying, oh, did you not have any kind of team orders to not fight Lando too hard? And he said, yes, we did. But once we got into the race, I just forgot about it and just started racing. And it was kind of almost like a, yep, sorry about that. It got to my head, Matt.
I always translate too hard as actually damage and or both of us have crashed out. Anything short of that is probably okay.
So tell us about this damage then, because we saw Gasly kind of ping off to the left and we went, oh, well, Gasly's hit someone, but we never really heard about that on the race commentary. So what's he done? He's gone and damaged the floor of Ricciardo. So that puts his performance into some context.
Yeah, it removed a pretty significant chunk of downforce from the car, which then made it harder to keep the tires alive for as long, and the car just doesn't handle as well once that happens. And we've seen it a lot. It's one of the worst areas for damage because it's the most important. You generate the most downforce for the least amount of drag from that area of the car. So it's critical to the overall performance and balance of the driving.
And even though the rear floor is where the biggest downforce cut for this year has happened, that's obviously the big regulation change that everyone's talking about. It's still a very important part of the car. And so getting a hit there is really going to hinder you. And I just think it was really clumsy from Gasly, to be honest. We don't often see him make mistakes like this. He had qualified fantastically, had a great opportunity to score a top five finish in the first race of the season. He blew it on the second racing lap.
Yeah, and this is what we're talking about. And amazingly, it's looking like it's going to be Ferrari or AlphaTauri right now being the real challengers to McLaren and the one person that could have really taken it to them and looked to have the car to do it was Gasly. And it was just, well, I mean, I guess we could use the word unfortunate if we want to be polite about it. But, you know, it was a bit of a surprising error from someone who won a race last season.
Well, I want to give Gasly a bit of a hug. I've been hearing these comments. I think they've been reported widespread. I think I caught it in motorsport.com. I'm not sure. Where Marco was basically going, well, if Verstappen was in that Toro Rosso, AlphaTauri, he would have been 3 seconds a lap faster and he would have finished fourth. And that that's not man management. Like, you do that if you want to force someone out. I don't think that's very, very encouraging. I mean, surely he's owed a little more from the Red Bull management in terms of just like even public respect, regardless of what is said in private.
Yeah, I would say so. But by the same token, he's really raised expectations for himself this season. So he's going to be judged with a very different lens. And Marco, you know, love him or lump him, he has his very distinct point of view. And that point of view is deliver or the door, basically. So if you're going to put yourself forward as I've won a race, I'm so good, I should be in a Red Bull. Mm. Well, then when you do something like that, you can expect that I will point out to you your errors.
Well, I don't think it is uncharacteristic, Chris. I'm just going to argue with you a little because I'm not even saying like, oh, it's an awful mistake and he really messed up. I'm just saying he's a very aggressive driver. That's completely in character.
He has a tendency to be quite aggressive. It's worked to his strength at some point. I mean, the one that I think of immediately was how he kind of refused to back out of passing Sergio Perez when he was squeezed to within centimeters of the wall heading towards Eau Rouge at Spa last year. Which was absolutely incredible. And that's one of those classic scenarios where when it pays off, you look like a hero. If Perez had actually fed him into the wall, we'd have been looking at Perez and going, well, what are you doing? You didn't leave him a car's width. But that, I don't know, that particular one, it just seemed like such a clumsy thing to do so early in the race.
Yet I'm going to go to Microsoft's comment in the live chat here. Hello, live chat room. Go and search for us on YouTube, like and subscribe the video. And if you click the bell, you'll get a notification when we go live. And you can chat and be part of the show and shape what we talk about. Microsoft says, I heard Gasly got into a fight with Newey. Sounds like it's more than just Helmut. And I've heard that too. And it does feel like, Chris, it feels like there's something personal, like there's some history. Did Gasly, you know, date the wrong person's daughter at some point?
He wrote a very emotive piece.
Oh, I never read it. It was, I meant to.
Very, very good. I'm sure you would have seen it doing the rounds on
social
media. He was talking mainly about that particular weekend at Spa when we lost Antoine Hubert, who he was obviously very, very good friends with. And obviously that was his first race back in the Toro Rosso or AlphaTauri at the time, having just been demoted from Red Bull. And so it was about how we managed to turn it around. But in that piece, he did talk about how he didn't feel like the team was behind him. You know, we've discussed what were Daniel Ricciardo's motivations for leaving Red Bull was the fact that it was becoming Max's team. One of them, given Gasly's almost testimony to that as well, almost seems to back up that case.
So I saw that article doing the rounds, and I have to admit I never clicked on it and read it because, you know, reading. I've not really read much since Netflix became good. But if you're going to openly talk like that, is it surprising then if the management doesn't love you by the race weekend and starts criticizing you? That's hand that feeds you.
I mean, we were talking about the driver market last year. I, for one, did not think Gasly would be doing another year at AlphaTauri. I thought he would go and move on to something like Renault or Alpine, as it now is. I genuinely don't think his future is with AlphaTauri. I don't think he is going to have another shot at the senior Red Bull team. And at that point, you've got to go and try and do something different. Tsunoda has got so much momentum behind him that I think they're already looking at where Tsunoda's future is over Gasly's. So he's got to try and find another route, whether that's within Formula One or within another series. That's it's up to him.
Well, the thing is, Jules, you don't criticise the coach, do you? You don't criticise the boss. That's how Megan Fox lost her role in the Transformers franchise. And it looks like Gasly's going the same way. But look, we do get good drivers out of that programme. Yes, it's brutal, but Verstappen got through that programme. Vettel got through that programme.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Is Verstappen really a Red Bull product? Hardly so. And I'm not sure about Sebastian Vettel. I think he's from an era where Red Bull hardly had this junior program going. He was Red Bull sponsored, but I don't think it's a question anymore whether Gasly is going to get the Red Bull seat or not. I think if you heard Christian Horner last season, if you hear Helmut Marko now, if you've seen Drive to Survive, you'd say there's no love lost between those guys anymore. Gasly is probably still there because AlphaTauri need a proper driver in their car. Gasly takes it because he's not there's not a seat available at Alpine right now because they're stuck with Ocon, probably due to a deal with Mercedes. And I don't think Gasly wants to be there anymore. They don't really want him there anymore. So
yeah,
I think like Chris said, this is a marriage with no love anymore.
Chris, it's like when you've got cheap rent that you can't afford on your own, and the lease has got another year to run, so you can't break up yet.
Yeah, it's so funny, Jules, that you talk about Verstappen not really being a product of the Red Bull system, because, of course, he very nearly joined Mercedes' young driver program. And I believe it was Jos who told him to go with Red Bull, who, of course, up until that point, had very much been kind of pushing his career. And don't forget, Verstappen only did 1 year of actual car racing before arriving in Formula One. And that was a season in Formula Three, straight from karting.
Yeah, that's true. I'll not elaborate on it too much, but Jos has sponsored his career up until he got signed by Red Bull. He did a winter program before his Formula 3 season in the Ferrari class in the United States. And Mercedes thought they had a good deal, but then the decision was Red Bull because they could offer him a race seat immediately, yeah. And that then it was a done deal. But that's it's not a Red Bull program product at
fair
all in that perspective.
Fair enough. We're going to roll back around to Verstappen in a bit, Matt. We did get derailed by Gasly chat, and we started that on McLaren chat. That's fine. I enjoyed that, digging into the Red Bull program a little bit. But we hadn't quite finished up with McLaren, had we? Certainly from my point of view, here's my takeaway with McLaren. For as optimistic as we are, McLaren are actually a sign that the top two are very far ahead, because we are celebrating the third team who were 45 seconds off the lead. Nah, it's still kind of far behind, Jules.
It actually reminded me of that season. I think it's two seasons ago when you had Ferrari and Mercedes battling. Then you had a whole lot of nothing, Red Bull, a whole lot of nothing, and then the rest of the teams. And I'm not a fan of doing season predictions based on the first race, especially in a climate like Bahrain's. But if this is something to go on, it could well be that McLaren is that in that position.
Well, the good news for you, Jules, is that Bahrain is a particularly power-sensitive track, and we know that the Honda and Mercedes power units are fairly square on power. And in fact, it may surprise some people to know that Red Bull, at least, had to turn their power down a bit because they had some cooling issues that were software, not hardware related. And as far as McLaren being in a bubble by themselves, although this race looked like it, I think going forward, you're going to see, just from the words of AlphaTauri, the technical director, Jody Eddington, saying, they have developments coming the next three races. It's incremental. There's no headline grabbers, but by Spain, we should have a nice step forward. That is terrifying language from a Formula One technical director. Whenever they say they've fixed their problem and it's revolutionary, you do not want to bet on them. But when they say it's going to be really boring, you won't see much, but we expect incremental steps, that's when you got to watch out, because they are running. They have the same philosophy. I remember Summers talking about this. Just a neutral car that's easy for the drivers to handle, and being very careful and precise with the updates, making sure they do what they're supposed to do. And I think we could see a really titanic battle between AlphaTauri and McLaren this season, and it's going to be delightful with Tsunoda in the mix. Absolutely. As long as they don't try and qualify him on medium tires again.
I think we need to talk Honda very, very soon. I just want to answer Notabir in the chat room, who says Bottas was also 40 seconds off. I think it was like 35 seconds. However, just a bit of housekeeping, Valtteri Bottas pitted late to claim the fastest lap, which he did. He put on brand new tyres and went and got the fastest lap. Chris.
Yeah, and Andy lost 10 seconds with that slow stop as well.
Yeah.
So it's funny, these first two races, we couldn't have much more different circuits to open up the season. Bahrain, which is a very power sensitive circuit with four quite long straights,
huge,
three DRS zones and hot climate, to then move to Europe in early spring, probably quite cold, and a very, very high downforce circuit in the form of Imola. Certainly in the midfield, I would expect to see a bit of a shake up in the comparative order compared to what we saw in Bahrain. I think between Red Bull and Mercedes, Red Bull will probably edge a little bit further ahead, but the midfield should be really shaken up because it's just a completely different challenge to what we saw in Bahrain.
Yeah, absolutely. Jules?
What Matt said about it could be a McLaren AlphaTauri battle, that also has a nice translation into the Merck versus Red Bull battle. Because AlphaTauri being Red Bull's B team, Mercedes has obviously power to make McLaren maybe a bit work a bit for them. And in that aspect, how much further will Honda be able to push their power unit, already having pulled it forward 1 year and pulling out technically after this season? And how much how much development is Mercedes willing to put in, or how much is Mercedes willing to give McLaren, referring to the engine modes available to the Lotus team of Matthew Carter in one of the shows he did.
Yes,
this could be really interesting if it pans out like Matt just said.
That's a great segue into Honda, but again, just a little bit of housekeeping there with the relationship with Mercedes and McLaren. So, for example, there's no Mercedes logos on the McLaren car. And I believe that's just because, you know, as part of their deal, McLaren are paying. They're just paying. They're much more of a traditional customer than, say, what we now describe as a customer team when we talk a little bit about power and B team. So I've no doubt that Matthew Carter's Lotus, maybe they were getting a good deal. So perhaps, you know, they've got a bit of influence there. With Williams, there's a driver there that is probably there because of Mercedes. In fact, there's no probably about it, is there? George Russell is a Mercedes driver. I'm not sure there's that same influence with McLaren, although you never know. You never know what's going on in the background. But with Honda, there's definitely, like, there's ultimate power. You could see Gasly, you're going really well, but let's change your pit strategy completely, or let's leave you out to make sure that you're at least slightly annoying for Lewis Hamilton, who's just pitted and needs to do a great outlap, for example. But I think we do need to talk about the Honda, and how much has Honda's improvements accounted for Red Bull's competitiveness? If you know, both McLaren and Red Bull, they didn't have the horsepower to do the aero things they wanted to do. And it now looks like Red Bull, if you look at where they're fast, it looks like they can do the aero things they want to do, Matt. So does that mean that Honda's taken a big step?
Yeah, it has taken a massive step forward. And just to put it into perspective, a post-race analysis at Bahrain showed Mercedes losing in turns 2, 5, 6, and 10. And this is the crucial thing to me. Going into recovery mode sooner at the end of straights than the Honda in the Red Bull. So we are seeing for the first time, Mercedes always has had its hand up. I'm the winner when it comes to ERS efficiency over a lap. I deploy more longer than anyone else. We are not seeing that this time around. And I know I have a lot of information about what's going on with that power unit, but I think Chris might want to get in here.
I need to ask a question. I'm gonna pull sure, host rank, because when you talked about which corners are quick, which ones they have an advantage in, out of turn two, sort of through the kink of turn three, is it traction zones then where the Honda's looking good?
Medium and high speed corners. I think low speed corners, Mercedes is still kind of maybe a little quicker than them. But where we're talking about deploying power on exit,
yes,
and apex speed in those turns, specifically Red Bull was winning.
Right, interesting. Chris?
So I think it's very clear at this point that Honda has been able to take a huge step forward. They're even saying that they reckon they've just edged out Mercedes, perhaps in terms of outright power. Of course, there are several more factors to a modern Formula One power unit that you have to take into consideration. The ERS deployment being one of them, how it performs with the various engine modes, and of course, the reliability. I think the other thing that has really played into Red Bull's strength is figuring out the issues they had with the aerodynamics on the car last year. Of course, the rear diffuser stalling out because they were having all these correlation issues with the wind tunnel. They've sorted those by the looks of it. So that's a huge factor as well. And also that Mercedes have had their wings clipped seemingly more than Red Bull. If you look at the comparative times for Bahrain between 2020 and 2021, the low rake teams that we've been discussing, teams like Aston Martin and Mercedes, have lost the most amount of time, whereas Red Bull seem to have lost almost about half of the deficit.
They just did a better job solving the problem, my friend, is what I would reply to you. I know Aston, before we talk about Honda, has been a bit on the nose, saying they were so victimized because they're a low rake team, to which I would want to reply, well, no one twisted your arm to copy Mercedes now, did they?
Yeah.
That was a choice you made. But we can get into that. I want to talk about Honda. We've brought it up before. What they've done specifically, they've done a lot with the power unit. And it, really what happened was the Honda engineers looked at their plans for a 2022 engine, and they talked to their chief, Yasuaki Asaki, and said, can we please move these plans forward to the 2021 season? And he went to the big boss at Honda and said, you should probably do this. It's our last season running this effort. And they talked him into it. Magnificently, they talked him into it. So starting in October, with 6 months to go to Bahrain, they did the following things. They changed the camshaft layout. They made it more compact. They moved it lower. They changed the valve angles in the cylinders. They improved the efficiency of the combustion chamber. They lowered the center of gravity, moving everything downwards. They changed the bore pitch, the distance between the actual cylinder bores themselves.
Wow.
And the new engine they have is smaller than the original size zero they put in at McLaren. Now, if you ask me, can I think of another power unit manufacturer that has made a change so late? I would say yes. Mercedes, going into year 2014, when they made the decision to split the compressor and the turbocharger and run it down the V of the engine. It's an astonishing engineering miracle. They got this engine to show up and to be this reliable. And by everything they're demonstrating, the performance improvements have put them at or ahead of Mercedes. We don't really know because Mercedes has the additional handling issues. We don't really know quite where they are because they don't have, I don't think, the aero to fully display that yet.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Scary if it's true that Red Bull was suffering a little bit with what Mercedes have done in the past, which is, oh, we've got this wonderful engine now and it's overcooked a little and we have to turn it down. So maybe some bigger intakes next race, next time round, really unleashing. That's scary if they are slightly ahead and they still have yet to unleash everything they can use.
Yeah, but I think there's big margin for improvement on both sides. Mercedes, obviously, with their sort of handling issues, and Red Bull in terms of their engine performance, whether they are having to cut some extra holes in the bodywork to improve the cooling for that engine, therefore costing them downforce. We'll see as the season goes on. Just a sort of general comment for sort of up and down the field. You know, I think a lot of the consensus is that they've recouped the actual aerodynamic downforce that they've lost with the cuts in the floor. The reason we're seeing slower lap times is mainly because of the tires, which are of a lower grip compared to the ones used in 2020.
Good.
And they're a little bit heavier, 3 kilos per set.
Good. Groove tires. That's the way forward, Chris. Groove tires. Good. No one's going to argue with me on that. And if you do want to, of course, you're always welcome to get in touch with us. We have feedback@missedapex.net. You can also email Matt@missedapex.net, and also me, Spanners@missedapex.net. Chris, do you want a fancy email too?
Sure, go on. Why not?
We'll sort one out. Why should I get all the abuse? I'll share it with you.
Yeah, people, you can tweet me as well if you don't like me, or just leave a nasty comment on the YouTube channel.
@ChrisOnRacing if you want to follow Chris on Twitter. I would like to just circle back around a little bit to the reaction to last weekend, and focusing in on you, obviously, Jules, as our token Dutch panelist. I'm interested in how we saw how the Dutch media and the Dutch fan base reacted to that, because we saw a lot of hurt from Max Verstappen fans. And honestly, it was cruel. That was Max's race. You can look at my Twitter timeline. And I said, look, Max has got this. And I was like, and I even said, I don't mind who wins. This is amazing. I think Max has got this, and it bodes really well for the future. It got snatched away. And obviously we came under the accusations I was talking about. You're a Ham Fosse podcast. It leads to an interesting discussion about supporting drivers and teams along national lines. I think in Britain, we've always been, you know, backing the British drivers, and we've been lucky. We've had Mansell, Hill, Coulthard, and then, you know, into, why can't I remember any other British drivers? But then into like Jenson Button as well, and to Lewis Hamilton, Chris. We've always, as a country and as a media, we've gotten behind the British drivers. So we've kind of got that default.
I don't want to be the one to kind of point the floor out there, but has anyone else noticed that kind of stopped when Lewis Hamilton started coming along? We've done it with every other British driver, and then Lewis Hamilton came along, and it was all, oh, I don't really like him
that much. I see what you're driving at, but if you turn up to Silverstone and you're in the stands, you're under absolutely no illusion whatsoever as to who the crowd are supporting. They're very, very much behind Lewis Hamilton. So Brits get accused of just being very Brit-focused. What I would say, Jules, is that we are Brit-supporting. We support the British drivers by default. So everyone knows here that I'm a big Perez fan. Before the last season, believe it or not, I was a Grosjean supporter. But, you know, you keep that quiet, don't you? But in the Netherlands, you know, you guys have really got, as a nation, behind Max Verstappen. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It, to me, it's just a default sport thing. You support your hometown, you support your country at the World Cup, you cheer for your country at the Olympics. It just gives you, as a supporter, a bit of skin in the game.
Yeah. The thing is, he's the first Dutch Formula One driver actually able to really win something, to really achieve something in this sport. And it's a television sport, mainly, of course. And so, you get big audiences quite easily. I think I explained this, a bit before on the show that, Dutch sports followers, viewers, they like to party. They like to have a party. And when there's success, when something becomes popular, it attracts a whole new breed, a whole different type of fan or supporter. Like the orange stands in Austria or Belgium. That's also people just wanting to have a good time and not really bothering with Formula One or the rules, let alone turn four track limit rules and whatever. So all they know is Max is a prodigy. He's been put out there as a future world champion from pretty much the beginning. Like, he wins everything. He's Jos's son, but then better. And he's won every race class that he's been in. So it was just like, he's going to be a world champion. It's just a matter of when. And especially this season, with the way winter testing went, there was this whole buildup, and it was, you know, some media or fan outlets, they had already almost branded him as this year's champion.
Yes.
Just because of that, you know. So if that, especially in the first race, you know, FP1, FP2, FP3, qualifying, on top of the charts,
by some way in qualifying as well. Yeah.
So, and then if and even the race fit in very well with that narrative. You know, he was on P1, lost a position, and then he was crawling back, and he was bound to get that position back from Hamilton, and then it just was gone, and it. Especially because it's hard to understand with the way things would turn four and the rules, etc.
Oh,
went.
Yeah,
that just fed the frustration, not able to understand what happened here. Oh, we were robbed, you know.
Yes, exactly. Like, and I will definitely pin the FIA rules there for being ambiguous, maybe not communicated well, maybe shouldn't have changed over the weekend. That's been done to death in media. Obviously, a lot of the Dutch fans that I was interacting with were just out and out saying, well, Hamilton's a cheater. Here's a video of 29 times he went off track. I would suggest that that's possibly misdirected. But I got some really good reactions from some Dutch F1 fans who just went, mate, enjoy it while it lasts. because you're going to be sad for the rest of the year. And as a sports fan, I can take that. I think that's brilliant, being able to give people needle just in a respectful way. You know, if I'm a neutral in an event, I'll stick a quid on it just so that I've got some skin in the fight. But the Dutch F1 fan base seems to have just embraced that spirit. And I think that has surprised a lot of the rest of the F1 community.
Yeah, there's two things to this. One, Dutch people on social media, especially Twitter, are pretty vocal. I think we are generally known as or seen as direct in our communication,
sure,
the way we talk to people. And if you take that to Twitter, it just like multiplies that. And you have to understand the way Dutch F1 fans are bound to get fed with F1 information, like how it's broadcasted, right, how it's commentated on, how it's analyzed.
Do you think that they get a feed that is very Max-centric? Do you think it's a slanted feed, in your opinion?
Absolutely.
You think so? Yeah.
Yeah, the Dutch F1 broadcaster is a commercial company. It's not a...
like a national station, yeah.
Yeah. So they are there to sell their subscriptions. And they know if you just put the word Max or Verstappen in your title, in your promos, in your analysis, you know, that's what's gonna draw the big audience. It's just exactly the audience that isn't too much into F1, you know. And I don't want to offend anyone, but there's a whole new audience to be pulled in to gain. And how are you gonna reach out to them? Like, by playing the Max is awesome card and pay or give us your money so you can see this, or be more
balanced,
objective, yeah, and more nuanced.
Oh my goodness!
It's the way the sport is presented to them. And oh my goodness!
Yeah, Chris, yeah, you would never catch a British outlet just chasing the clicks and the algorithms, would you? Jeez, that's awful.
Absolutely not. Now, I'm quite curious to know if there was a big Dutch following of F1 before Max arrived in the series, just because I know, you know, they obviously had a Grand Prix a few years ago that's coming back, thankfully. And I think there's a general trend of how coverage of Formula One starts in a certain country, where you're focused on a particular individual or a particular team based on nationality. And then as the years go on, it sort of expands. You know, Formula One has been broadcast in the UK since the very beginning. And even though Britain has a lot of success in Formula One and most of the teams are based in Britain, I think the fact that it's been around for so long is why we encompass the entire sport rather than one driver or one team.
Yeah, that's very different over here. The Dutch Grand Prix was last held in 1985. And I think 1992, I could be a year off, was the first season that was completely broadcasted in the Netherlands. So you would have races on and off. But that was the first season it was completely broadcasted. And then when Jos Verstappen came in, there was quite a big explosion of F1 popularity. But then when he went, that kind of faded, and you had a couple of not so successful Dutch drivers. And then with Max, it just boomed. And last weekend, the Bahrain Grand Prix had a record audience of 2.5 million viewers.
Wow.
On a population of 17 million. That's, you know, quite big. So it's blew up immensely since Max came in, and you have the licensed broadcaster. But apart from that, you're pretty much down to a lot of F1 websites, of course, who understand very well that if you put the name of Max into your headers, into your titles, into your podcast titles, that's what generates clicks, of course. And you have podcasts hosted by fans, you know, but it makes things very one dimensional if you if that's what you if that's your F1 menu, your diet.
Good. So there are Dutch versions of Spanners out there being as Max Fosse as we are Ham Fosse, and I don't mean to suggest for a second that British broadcasters aren't showing bias towards Lewis Hamilton. I'm sure there are biases that I miss because I've got my British head on and my hat on. Certainly, I would say the BBC broadcast generally cheers on the British drivers more than the other ones. But it feels like it's natural. We are going to move on a little bit, Jules, with apologies. We're running short on time because we've got a tech feature that we're going to run where Matt caught up with race car engineering deputy editor Stuart Mitchell. But just before we get there, I think we do need to squeeze in just a little bit about Ferrari, because they look so promising in qualifying. We forgot about them pretty much during the race and they seem to go anonymous. Why? What does that mean? And where do we go?
Tires. Literally, they just can't manage the tires yet. They have the one lap pace, but they cannot sustain it over the course of an entire Grand Prix. And that for them, at least in Bahrain, it may be different at different venues, is the main thing. If they can get on top of their tire wear, they will be much closer to this sort of mythical AlphaTauri McLaren battle we've sort of been discussing all show. The other thing is they haven't fully recovered all the power they've lost from the agreement they made with the FIA in the previous season. They're much closer, but they still have some steps to make, unlike Honda. And as far as Renault goes, I think power-wise, they are probably a little bit in the same place, but we don't know because the rest of their car was so terrible. We don't have a clue yet.
And it's fair enough that they haven't recovered all of that horsepower yet. I mean, just trying to get back to where they were would have been hard enough, but then to also catch up with the step that Renault, that Mercedes, that Honda have made between 2020 and 2021 as well would have been a huge, order. So the fact that they are where they are is in itself already quite impressive.
Matt, and I just want to
go on, Matt. Sorry.
So I just want to bring up is a quick general issue because it came up earlier in the thing, and I think it's a good time to put it here. No team, no matter where they are, and this includes Ferrari saying, oh, look, we could be closer to McLaren. No team wants to spend any more time than absolutely necessary working on this year's car. And I hold up for you Haas, which is bringing a single development this year, new brake ducts and a race or two. They've already had their car, their 2022 car in the wind tunnel like six times, more than any other team. Every team is desperate to get started on next year's regulations because there's such a big, big change. So any team you support is going to be balancing out the cost of time spent on this year's car versus next year's car. And that's all I want to say about that.
I want to say that I still think Ferrari are down on power, and to quote an article from racer.com, so written by Chris Medland, he got a quote from Leclerc saying, we still want to make progress with the engine. It's clearly the engine is still an issue. They haven't solved everything.
Yeah, no, I don't think we're arguing that. But in terms of what limited them in the Bahrain race, it was less their total power, because you could see they were closer to McLaren over a single lap, and more their ability to manage the whole chassis, the tires and everything over the course of a whole race, part of which will be the energy deployment. And of course, the aero doesn't work as well when you can't go as fast, when your engine isn't as powerful. We know that connection is there.
All right. We've got plenty of time until the next race, haven't we, to cover a lot of the issues we've missed today. Wanted to talk about some Williams stuff, Aston Martin as well. And I really wanted to get deep into Vettel's woes. So we'll dedicate a bit of time to that next weekend as well. Not from a Schadenfreude point of view. I promise you, I am definitely wishing Vettel well this season. Some of you out there who have been listening for a while might be able to guess why. And welcome to the new people who have joined us over the off season. It's really, really hard to tease out figures for podcasts, and a lot of the time, podcasts just don't bother issuing their figures because it is such a minefield. But after a week, after a full week since that last review, Matt, I think we have got about a 20% bump in our audience over the off season. So I would just like to thank everyone who took the time to share the podcast. You can always just share the link, mistapex.net, and that will take you to the homepage. If you say to your friends, mistapex.net, they'll get there and they'll see the video and audio for the latest episode. So it's two clicks. One, they'll click the link you share, and two, they're listening or watching Missed Apex podcast. I'll share a little bit more about the figures for the Bahrain Grand Prix because I think it's interesting and I'm really, really proud of them. But I think there's a chance that I'll be sitting here next week telling you that we had an audience of 30,000 individuals that tuned in to watch or listen to our Bahrain Grand Prix. And honestly, Matt, that is a number that is so hard to digest. We probably shouldn't linger on it. You don't want to think about that amount of people in front of you whilst you're 8 minutes into a rant about a front left tire.
No, you don't. You don't want to think about the fact that maybe over 1,000 people are watching you live
instantly. Yeah.
As you turn, you know, a chicken dinner into winter chicken or something like that. It's just not good to think about that too much when you're in the midst of trying to actually record the show.
Live on radio this morning, I forgot which way the sun rises and sets, got it completely wrong, and people were sure to tell me about it. And sure enough, when we get things wrong, we get feedback here as well. And you're more than welcome to email us feedback@missedapex.net, or you can even support us if you would wish to give us the power, the time, and the resource to do more things within Formula One Media, like the written content that you can find linked in the show notes. You can support us at patreon.com/missedapex. Now, we had 8,000 people nearly join us live on Sunday, and we love doing the live stuff. But every now and then, we do want to turn our attention to some pre-recorded content. And earlier in the week, we caught up with Stuart Mitchell from Race Car Engineering magazine, and we recorded just a little 20-minute segment. Once that's done, we're going to come back live and do comment of the week. But for now, enjoy this.
This week, we are joined by Stuart Mitchell, the deputy editor of Race Car Engineering magazine. And it's a real-life physical magazine that you can buy and put on the coffee table and even take it to your favorite room where you like to read by yourself. And we've even gotten many messages from listeners that they were delighted because last time he was on, we said, go out and buy the thing. They bought the thing and they really loved it. Well, guess what? Guess who's back? Stuart Mitchell. And he has some very exciting news for us. Welcome back, Stuart.
Guess who's back? Yes, thanks very much, Matt. Appreciate it. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we're delighted. So now you have a brand new edition of your magazine, Race Car Engineering, on the shelves. And excitingly enough for me, it's all about the future of the Formula One power unit.
Yes, that's right. So this time round, we have we've had an amazing bunch of discussions with some leading technology specialists across motorsport and specifically in Formula One about what the next generation is going to look like. So Formula One brought the regulations forward 1 year. So we're looking at the next set of generation, next generation coming in 2025. And there's going to be some real changes on the table at the moment for that generation of the sport.
Well, that's amazing. And you know me, I want to get right to the nitty gritty. So what is Formula One wanting to achieve with this power unit? And way more importantly, how are they thinking about getting there?
Well, at the moment, the power units look like they're going to stay as hybrids. So this is sort of the most, that as headlines go, the most most important piece to remember. So on the table was a series of, hopes and dreams from the governing body about what they might look at in terms of technology for the next time round. So it looks like we're going to stick with hybrids, but this time we're looking at 800 kilowatt units. But now they're going to be split 50-50 between internal combustion engine and electrical power. So that's 400 kilowatts each per power source, whereas now we're looking at way less than that for the electric side, because they can only deliver what is the equivalent to 160 horsepower. Then they'll be able to deliver, you know, a lot closer to 500 with the electric side of things. So it should be pretty impressive stuff as we move to that next generation.
And I assume that's partly because if you look at high-end sports cars or hypercars, this is the kind of split we're seeing there. So this is maybe where the manufacturers want to go. But also, I mean, I've heard other people say that we could already get a lot more out of the current electric system on the car.
Yes, we could. But there's limitations in place to control those who are, across the grid, those who are buying products and just pressing the buttons that the manufacturers tell them to press. And then there's the others who design, develop, and then deploy those products themselves. So if you're a factory team, you have more knowledge, more intelligence on a product and how to get the best out of it than you would as a customer. So, you know, the current 550 kilowatt IC engines plus the 120 kilowatt provided by the battery packs is where you can easily sell a product, quote, off the shelf to your customers, and they can easily operate it and get it going. So moving on to the next generation, we're just taking all of that a little bit higher. And, you know, the requirements for the teams will be higher in terms of their engineering expertise as well.
Right. So that being the case, it's a huge change. It's a huge change in terms of the power coming from the electrics. Are they going to keep the MGU-H? I mean, I know that's always been targeted as being a hugely expensive part of it. And more importantly, how are they going to actually manage this new amount of electric power?
So this is where it becomes very interesting, because you're absolutely right. The MGU-H is as systems go, you know, expensive and complex to use and to manage, because you're taking, you know, that exhaust gas, you're taking some of it, you're using it as charging electrical power, and then you're deploying some of that electrical power to spool up the compressor side to then run the IC engine at a higher output. It's extraordinarily complex to get those things right. So, you know, on the table is, you know, the concept to withdraw less from an MGU-H or even take it off the table altogether, and to continue to be able to produce the same amount of energy and in fact increase the amount of energy to 800 kilowatts overall. They're looking at introducing four-wheel drive system, and this is primarily around bringing that energy from the braking on the front axle into the powertrain.
Wait, four-wheel drive? Seriously?
Right.
I mean, what's next? Cruise control? Why would they need four-wheel drive? And I mean, because I did look it up. I have this complaint about we switched to kilowatt units from brake horsepower. And I think engineers just do that once they think normal people understand what they're talking about. But I know that's around 1,000 brake horsepower, which is about where they expect the cars to be now. Why do we need four-wheel drive suddenly to manage it when Formula One has mostly always been rear-wheel drive?
So this is quite an interesting one on the table at the moment, because, okay, so four-wheel drive means that the axles will be connected to the powertrain, or the front and rear axles. So the point that we've got going on at the moment is, in order to achieve 800 kilowatts, 400 kilowatts of which will be electrical powertrain, you need a ton more recovery. You need way more recovery. And in order to be able to do that in a kinetic format, you need to do that through the braking system. And it's quite obvious, I think, for most people who understand the physics that happen in a braking zone, the car lurches forward, you have much more energy over the front axle, which means that it's able to have a lot more braking force. It can contain a lot more braking force and slow the car down a lot more than the rear axle. And so that's kind of the first driver is the energy recovery on that front axle. And that's where they're going to this four-wheel drive, or thinking about at least this four-wheel drive solution.
So the way you describe it, you're really talking much more about four-wheel recovery, energy recovery, than you are about four-wheel drive. But given that, are you also saying that we have two wheels of recovery now, we will potentially have four wheels of recovery, but you're saying we should have more than double the energy that could be recovered because of the weight shift to the front and most of the braking being done at the front into a braking zone?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So that's the primary driver for the introduction of four-wheel drive in this case. But of course, if you can recover, and the front axle is only electrical in this sense, so it only is connected to the drive units that are part of the electrical system, so an electric motor in this case, what is an MGU. If you're only putting that on the front axle, if you can recover, you can also deploy. So whether or not they move into a four-wheel drive formula with deployment as well is still up for grabs, because there some purists certainly feel like it would retracts a lot from the DNA of Formula One. So we'll see how that sort of pans out as the discussions broaden.
So you don't yet understand or know for sure that deployment will be allowed with the electric motors on the front axle. That's still a detail to be determined. Did you get a sense of, is that something they would like to engage in? And if it does come to pass, what kind of effect could we see on the handling of the cars? I mean, does this open the door to like every toy we've ever talked about, but not been able to play with?
It could do. So here's the interesting scenario, if you like. What other four-wheel drive formulas that use hybrid technology have done, i.e. the LMP1s of the recent past, is that they've only allowed the front deployment of the MGU to be used over a certain speed. So this is where it becomes quite interesting. So they were only able to use them, I think, over 125 kilometers an hour. And that means that you don't actually get that enormous benefit. So the primary benefit of electrical power being that it can deliver 100% torque from zero RPM. And that means that from slower speeds, your acceleration can go up at an incredible rate. They're limiting where you can use it and how it can be deployed. So that's also on the table for Formula One under this framework of discussions.
So it sounds very much like the goal would be, even if this was allowed, the goal would be to keep it from aiding in traction events during a turn and exiting a turn.
Somewhat, yes. So, but that is, I mean, 125 kilometers an hour doesn't, perhaps, I guess, for a road car would seem, you know, quite a decent speed. But if you consider the average pace of a Formula One car around some of these circuits, there are some circuits that will, you know, almost never go out of that frame where the car is going too slow to deploy electrical energy, in which case you would have, you know, almost 100% of the lap being allowed to drive in four-wheel drive, at which point you're basically completely ruining the terms around which the you know, deployment strategy has been put in place. So it needs to be highlighted and isolated in a bit more detail, I think.
Okay. And just out of extreme curiosity, have they discussed the option of allowing individual motors to drive individual tires, wheels at individual speeds? Or do you get the sense that this will be a linked thing where the one motor has to drive both the wheels at the same speed with whatever diff they install to account for the usual turny bits?
Well, this is where it's going to become interesting. It depends on how the diff is sorted in the regulations. The likelihood is that they will have the diff, the front diff in this case, as a listed part. So they won't be able to do any developments. It'll be a spec part. So they won't be able to do any developments on it. So everybody will have to use the same system, whether it's electronic, I imagine it will be electronic. It's unlikely that there'll be allowed torque vectoring or things of the sort. It'll probably be quite wide open, obviously, to allow regular steering as we have now, in terms of the locking ability of the diff. And then you will electronically lock it at a certain point using electronics as you're boosting away. But it's not going to be ultra torque vectoring or anything like that at the moment. That's not on the table.
Okay, so it sounds like, if I understand you, the plan is to introduce this mainly for recovery, to probably allow it for deployment at a set speed, or, I mean, I can't imagine why they wouldn't just decide based on the circuit characteristic, this week you're only allowed to deploy above X speed. Like, say, Monza is going to be a little bit different than Monaco. Yes. And the main goal of this is to not have an effect on the steering of the car so that it remains the driver using the throttle to drive the rear wheels to get the car around the turns as fast as possible.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So in terms of the rear wheel drive, front wheel drive split, that's still up for discussion in terms of how they figure it out. If they allow 50-50, then, of course, you're going to have a very different strategy than you would if they allow 60-40, 70-30, so on and so forth. So the deployment is the interesting discussion at the moment, because if you're just able to recover and then you have to deploy on the rear axle, then it follows very much the same concept as we have today, but the contribution from electrification is higher. And that's about it. Whereas if you go for front axle operation in terms of deployment as well, we're going to have a very, very different acting car in this case.
Okay. We have delved into this, and I have a follow-up question. We've talked about four-wheel drive, which has never been on the table before. I occasionally hear hints that maybe movable aero will come back, adjustable ride height. What other areas are being looked at? And I know those aren't technically power unit regulations. I want to follow up in just a second on those. But is there anything else like that being considered to help with this transition or to help bring the manufacturers and toys they play with on their hypercars, but Formula One right now is not developing?
Well, this is a very interesting one. Formula One is so aero-dependent that if you were to change something that's aerodynamically affecting, then that's where you're going to make the biggest differences in terms of the formula. Of course, we know that from 2020 to 2021, they lost 10% by cutting small triangles out of the back floor and shaving off 50 millimeters off of the bottom of the diffuser. So that's made a huge difference. You're talking 10% by very, very small margins. So active aero is something that is on the table and is actually part of the discussions across motorsport, because it is, we are able to implement it. We have, you know, semi-active, or should we say activated by driver aerodynamics or changes in aerodynamics with DRS. If they were automatically activated, this becomes, you know, a software challenge, which is far more complex than I think the Formula One and any other motorsport wants to go into. But that's on the table. And if it's part of the discussions, and it's important to consider all of these plans are in place to provide a more sustainable future for Formula One. So it isn't just about electrification and that percentage going up, or how that might turn into four-wheel recovery or even four-wheel deployment as well. It's about the bigger picture of Formula One, looking at sustainability. So for them to use less fuel, for example, and fuel is another really interesting point and a really interesting part of these discussions. For them to use less fuel, they need to have less drag. And for them to activate automatic or using active aerodynamics is a very straightforward way to implement a lower fuel consumption for these vehicles. And the fuel itself is looking to make some changes as well.
Right. Well, I think Lotus Mass Dampers have just called and they would like a word with the Formula One aerodynamics people.
Yes.
Having been famously banned for being a movable aerodynamic device, we're now potentially going to have them in the name of using less fuel. So
in
let's
the name
talk about
of the efficiency and sustainability. Yes. Yeah.
Sustainability. Thank you for that word that I managed to forget in the 3 seconds since you last said it. And I'm going to skip over the effect all this will have on the tires, much to my utter dismay. And I really actually do want to talk about the fuels, because this is another area of great fascination. So right now, I believe we've moved from E5 to, was it E10 fuel?
That's right, yes. But actually, even further down the line and in the not too distant future, you know, in part of the discussions for 2025, is what's called e-fuel. And it's a bit of a bizarre one because we've got e-this and e-that, which indicates, you know, solely electric power in a lot of cases. But e-fuel is what's actually on the table at the moment. And what that is it's CO2 being used as a closed loop product. So we're taking it out of the air and using it to produce fuels.
Okay. So right now, just so I'm clear, if it's a small e, that means electric. If it's a big e in front of a number, that means the amount of ethanol added to the fuel. And right now they're using, I believe, non-food organic sources to manufacture that ethanol. Basically, they're fermenting it. But what you're talking about is literally capturing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and creating a fuel with it. Have they done that? Have they sent samples to manufacturers? Because I know there was some full synthetic fuel that was sent to manufacturers. Was it what you're talking about now, or was it still the plant-based stuff?
So those fuels that were sent to the manufacturers are a step forward, and they are biofuels. So they are what you're talking about. They're naturally grown, and you know that's the way that's that works. E-fuels are something altogether different. E-fuel is CO2 extracted from the atmosphere, and then they combine it with hydrogen and oxygen made out of water to create gasoline and other methanol-based fuels as well. They can also make paraffin, so diesels as well, for aircraft in this case as well.
So I assume one of the advantages of that, aside from the very, very green credentials you would get from making such a fuel and making it to the point where it could be used outside of a very niche sport, if you'll pardon me characterizing Formula One as such, is that you could really tailor the characteristics of the fuel to the demands of the car.
Yes, in this case you could, because it is a lab-based product. But in another sense, to be sustainable, and you know this is the big driver for this, you're capturing CO2 from the atmosphere and you're combining it with naturally occurring products to create fuel. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to close loop, create a net zero output of CO2 in the production process of this fuel. Now, when it is burnt, that's another discussion altogether, but you can control things, some of the additives, of course, if you're deciding what to add into this in order to generate, you know, the kind of emissions that you want as well. And again, this is another part of the discussion for the sustainable future of Formula One. You know, energy consumption as a whole, or energy output per kilogram of CO2, you know, is on discussion about bringing that in for part of the regulation set. So it's very interesting. The only thing that we've got at the moment, which is the biggest challenge, is that producing e-fuel by capturing CO2 from the air is extremely energy intensive, because you need to convert all those molecules into fuel. And so, you know, the industry is looking at many different sites and ways to do that, and to take that energy from wind and solar and so on to make it closed loop, clean and CO2 neutral in the production side of the fuel.
All right. So I just want to be clear about this. We've heard Pat Simmons talk about hydrogen. We've talked about biofuel we have now. You're talking about e-fuel. Did you get a sense that one of those three is the pick going forward as we look at these new regulations?
At the moment, e-fuel is on the table for the pick going forward, because at this stage, the amount of fuel being used over the course of a Formula One season is easily manageable. So to put it into perspective, it's about 3 million liters of fuel. And that's across all the teams, including testing, you know, on-track testing, off-track testing. So when they have their single cylinder modules for testing the engines, then of course any dyno runs, and then of course racing across the world. You're looking at 3 million liters. So you could produce that, and that's quite straightforward to produce. And you can work out how to use, where to use the energy, you know, from solar, from wind, from whatever else, in terms of that production of the e-fuel to make it closed loop sustainable. When you talk about the bigger picture, you know, for the road cars and the relevance of this technology for consumption for road vehicles, it becomes a very different discussion, because you have to map out where you're going to produce it and stuff like that. But at the moment, for Formula One, it's looking like a properly viable answer. However, if you talk to anybody else, you know, about the energy for the future, hydrogen is also on the table as well. And hydrogen for prototype racing at Le Mans is coming. And that's what they're working on in that space. And Formula One is talking to those chaps as well. And hydrogen is definitely on the table as a combustible fuel in internal combustion engines as well.
Okay, great. So before we get out of here, I have one more lengthy question that you're going to have to give a brief answer to.
Okay.
Which is, we've seen McLaren use, they're making their seat out of, flax grass now. And they're saying it's got properties similar to carbon fiber, the way they do it. Are we looking at potentially using advanced composites finally in the engine? Second question, right now we use turbulent jet ignition, but I've seen people talk about plasmas and lasers. Is that open now? Are we looking at a brand new ignition system that could be even more efficient? And finally, I don't know if you've heard of the Koenigsegg free valve, but variable valve timing and lifting, getting rid of the camshafts. Is this also something that might be considered, or have I now just dove into the deep end with my wish fantasy list here.
Well, I'll work these in a perhaps a different order. So talking about free valves are very interesting, fantastic technology. They're just banned in Formula One. Formula One regulations state that you must use a camshaft in its traditional format to open and close the valve. So they cannot be controlled by any other device or in any other way other than mechanical connection to the crankshaft. So that's the end of that discussion until they change the regulations. In terms of the seat using flax fiber, the McLaren using the flax fiber, it's very interesting. Flax fibers are definitely coming up in the world in terms of their replacement for things like carbon. However, at the moment, they are still about 40% heavier in terms of, you know, the layup. But of course, McLaren have worked out their compromises in that. And, you know, they perhaps in this case, they might be using a different resin and something a little bit tougher in that way to incorporate flax as the fiber instead of carbon. But I think in the short term future, recyclable carbon fiber will become much more a part of the solution rather than, you know, flax and things like that until they work out the best way to do it. And when you talk about ignition systems, you know, this is a very deep topic. In Formula One at the moment, they use some of the cars will operate and the engines will operate in what's called HCCI, which is homogeneous charge combustion ignition, where in certain states, they will actually combust spontaneously the combustion fluids inside the chamber. And that's controlled by temperatures and pressures rather than the ignition system itself. So in some cases, they don't use a spark plug at all. They will have it spontaneously, the fluid spontaneously combust at a certain speed, at a certain rate when they're under full load, for example. And other times they actually use pre-chamber ignition. And what that is a tiny, small combustion chamber above the major combustion chamber that contains the gas. And then it expands at a certain rate into the main chamber. And that's what gives them that really high energy density from a very small amount of fuel. So there's combustion science is definitely one for sitting down for hours to discuss.
Well, we'll have to do that soon. Stuart Mitchell, it has been an utter delight to have you back on the show. Thank you for taking the time to entertain my highly, highly uneducated questions and teach me a little bit more. And if you need even more detail, and I'm going to admit I do, please go find a copy of Race Car Engineering on the newsstands now and buy it for yourself. Will not regret it at all.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Matt. Really appreciate it.
Wow. A great pre-recorded segment there from Matt Trumpitz. And being able to put those midweek recordings out live to you on a Sunday gives us so many options because we can now approach people midweek and say, hey, instead of giving up like an hour on a Sunday night, and face familial and spousal pressure, come chat to us midweek and we can put it out on a Sunday. So I really hope you enjoyed that. The takeaway from that is go and find a copy of Race Car Engineering magazine at your local newsagents. I have been converted. I have not picked up a physical magazine for a while, but Race Car Engineering magazine has converted me, as has Race Weekend from our friend Magnus as well. And we're going to hear more about Race Weekend magazine, which is republishing the episode from its Kickstarter. So you can buy that edition very, very soon as well. During the course of the season, I hope that you will enjoy the variety of content that we're going to bring you, as well as the panel shows. We do, despite being accused of being a Hamfosi podcast, we do have panel from Denmark, panel from the Netherlands, France, America, Brazil, Australia. So we are an international, we are a global, we are a one world podcast, even if the annoying host sometimes comes across as a little bit Lewis Hamilton bias. However, there are also shows from Joe Sayward, who's been to every Grand Prix since 1998 and gives us an absolute wealth of knowledge. And even though I personally don't agree with all of Joe's opinions, we have a wonderful chat and it takes me a little bit out of my echo chamber. We occasionally catch up with the likes of Matthew Carter, who used to be the boss of Lotus F1. He jumps in every couple of months to give us that real inside look into life within the F1 circus. And we've got Summers F1, who is, I would say, probably the leading tech journalist at the moment. And he is the tech journalist for motorsport.com and does specialist tech shows with Matt. And we've got the likes of Chris Medlin from racer.com, who jumps in and sees us occasionally. And even Alex Brundle, who is now the F1 TV commentator, has been on this show several times. So hopefully you'll find something to keep you entertained here at Missed Apex Podcast. But our bread and butter is 8 p.m, the night of the race, wherever it's possible. We bring you that race review, that instant reaction, and we will have a race for you ready for your Monday morning commute, Matt. That's what we do. That's what we've based our whole advertising thing on.
Yes, and I know the reedy bits aren't necessarily your thing, but I will point out, for the record, I suspect that a lot of our writers secretly might like Ferrari.
Oh, no, yes. There is a big Ferrari contingent. When I was meeting all the writers over Zoom and I said that Ferrari were the Death Star, I was greeted with very... I don't think they saw the funny side of it, let's put it that way. So the written side certainly isn't a ham-fo-sy fest. However, every single show does end with an award.
Comment of the week.
During the races, we do a Good Thing Award, a Missed Apex Award, a Pony Award. But for our live chat room, for the comments that flood in during the live recording, we have a comment of the week. Who's your candidates, Matt?
All right, I'm just going to rock through these very quickly. We start with Mr. Bongers at the top of the show discussing the corners where Red Bull were faster and the corners where Mercedes might have an advantage. In other words, Mercedes is good at going slow because they seem to be doing well in the slower corners.
Oh, yes, so slow for P1, hashtag 44. Ah, there I go again. Who's the next nominee?
Evangelos Heteroclitus, discussing the remarkable discussion of tires from Chris Stevens and not me. In other Chris had a mild case of that.
Wow, he was infected with a dose of trumpets.
We have Mark Greenhowen with four-wheel drive. I'm quitting the sport if they go four-wheel drive. Although I said that when they stopped using cloth helmets, so you should probably ignore me.
There was a little objection in our live chat going, basically, why do we have to change things in Formula One? Why can't everything just be the same forever? I can understand that. I can sympathize. I'm getting kind of old now. Any change alarms me and terrifies me, but I'm excited to see what they can do with handling with four-wheel drive.
I want to see the free valve technology. I want to see the movable aero. I want to see what they can really do with an efficiency-based formula when they're set loose with tools like that, because it's going to be amazing. I mean, we're already at, I'm on a rant, we're already at 50% thermal efficiency. They're aiming at 60%+ for the next set of regulations, and I bet they get there and beyond.
I just anyway, give you 25 minutes of a regular show for tech, and you're going to interfere with comment of the week. Come on, man.
That interview could have been 3 hours.
And it will be. We will
count yourself lucky.
We will have Stuart back regularly throughout the season.
Jelmer Vanderlei, Vettel should have an advantage as a 4XWDC, four times a World Drivers Championship, because four-wheel drive.
I'm not feeling it. Who's the winner, Matt?
Spanners has made a face. And finally, we have Mike Stoner in with, this discussion gives me lots of fuel for thought.
Ugh, puns. Puns are terrible. Who wins?
That being the case, I think Mark Greenhow has to win. Four-wheel drive. I'm quitting this sport if they go four-wheel drive. Although I said that when they stopped using cloth helmets, so you should probably ignore me.
Comment of the week.
Thank you very much for joining us in the live chat. And thank you to everyone who shares our content. If you like it, maybe your friends will like it. It doesn't matter if you have one follower or a million followers. Just share missedapex.net and people will be directed in two clicks to our content. One click, clicking your link. The second click, they will have content that they possess. So please share missedapex.net. Consider supporting us at patreon.com/missedapex. The more we are supported, the more we can do. The more we're supported, the more we can spend time midweek finding interesting people to speak to you in the shed and deliver that as pre-recorded content on a Sunday as well. If you want to follow Matt, I guess, you can follow him at MattPT55 on Twitter. You can also email Matt at MissedApex.net. And if you want some romance novels, go and check out Matt's wife on Twitter at aweaverwrite. You, of course, can follow me. I would never be so immodest as to... Yes, I would. At SpannersReady on Twitter, or you can email me spanners@mistapex.net. Thank you very much for joining us. Always enjoy a casual non-race show, especially after the adrenaline of the Bahrain Grand Prix. I have a feeling that Imola is going to deliver just as much drama, but we've got a little while to wait yet. Wherever we see you next, though, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex. Oh, you were giving me that look, Matt, that kind of you've forgotten something look that always makes me panic.
No.
Oh.
No.
Good.
Nothing. That's it.
We did all the things.
We did.
Well, all right then. Have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday off. That's on me.
Sounds good. Now I just have to commence all my other jobs.
Oh, man, I'm not looking forward to everything opening up and having to compete with real trumpet playing for your time.
Yes, well,
I don't want to do that.
Should I invite the audience to go view my little concert that's up on Facebook Live?
We can put a link in the show notes.
I'll stick it under my usual things, but yeah, I did a concert yesterday and it was recorded on a phone. And if you would like to see what I get up to when I have an actual trumpet in my hands, you're welcome to go visit.
Or we can just follow Matt on Facebook and it is just pictures of trumpets. That's all he posts. Anyway.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.